All right, happy Tuesday evening, everybody. 1 week before the election to change the world. Okay, maybe I'm a little overdramatic on that. Possibly. Anyway, this is The Refinery, the collection of three grassroots organizations where we get together and talk about conservative messaging and how we're not just complaining about what other people are doing, we're talking about how we can be better and how we can make everybody better via the power of our own awesomeness. And I need to find a way to turn that into a slogan or something. I don't know. Anyway, I'm Leslie with Conservative Union. We've got Ryan Bickmore also with the Conservative Union. And then we have JD and Felicia with Free Radical Network. And we have Corey and Andy Pape with the Party of Choice. And we have our regulars over there in the chat room, and we'll be talking about them as well as talking to them probably. But we like talking about people a lot. Anyway, I have taken probably a little too much cold medicine or allergy medicine today, so if I'm a little more insane than usual, I won't remember, so what the heck. There was a really fascinating article that I read this week, and it was about, well, it was basically about the Walmart mom voter. And it, you know, on the one hand, it was really, really pretty depressing. It was published at the Federalist, written by D.C. McAllister. Yeah, there's my old eyes. And it was really how to reach the Walmart mom voter. And first, we have to understand what the Walmart mom is. And these are the people that we know. These are the people in our lives who don't pay any attention to politics. And they kind of are using that as a point in their own favor. They're kind of proud of the fact that they don't pay attention to politics. They care. They care deeply, but they don't know. Some people call them the low information voter, but that's not actually true. They have information about the things that they care about, and they just have not been inspired to care about politics. They will say they don't have the time, but when you explain to them that they have the exact same amount of time that everybody else does, because time is, of course, the resource that we all have the exact same amount of, they will acknowledge that politics just doesn't interest them, and they spend their time on other things, but they vote. And what happens is when they get surveyed by pollsters in the lead up to an election, they will say the things that are important to them are the economy and security and immigration and debt and trusting in government and all of the issues that conservatives are really big on and really good on. They'll say that freedom and liberty are important to them if somebody asks. They don't really use those terms. But then when it comes to showing up at the voting booth, what happens is their emotions kick in and they will vote for, because they don't know who the candidates are, they don't know what the positions are, they end up voting their emotions and they will vote for whoever they feel is most like them. And that's where Democrats kick our butts, because the Democrats, Wendy Davis will convince more women at the last moment, and at the last moment, I mean right before they vote, Wendy Davis will convince more women to vote for her than have said they would vote for her beforehand. Because when it comes right down to it, they will say, oh, Wendy's a mom just like me. And so Wendy Davis will get a disproportionate amount of votes because they feel something about Wendy. And we can complain all we want that the world should not be that way, that people should care more about politics and care like we do, and they should study and they should learn. But we have to deal with the world as it is. And these people are actually voting, and I'm glad that they are. I'm glad that they are participating in our government as much as they are. We have to the onus is on us to reach them and to persuade them that when they make that emotional decision to vote for the person who's most like them, that they vote for our candidates, not the Democrats' candidates. And I don't know how to do that. And it's not going to be our candidates that do that. It's going to be us that convince the people that we know that aren't involved in politics, that convince them to vote conservative. And I don't know how we do that. So I'm going to kind of toss it out there. What kind of ideas do you guys have? Everybody's muted.
Okay. Excuse me. It's hard. First of all, the it was a terrifying article.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because at first I honestly thought it was being needlessly nasty toward them, depicting them as almost superhumanly stupid.
Right. Like intentionally, selectively.
Right. It was almost like comedy.
Right.
You're not serious. I thought this was like some slanted, you know, man on the street look, you know, from late night comedy TV, finding the dumb ones. And I don't mean to put it this way. I'm sorry, but that's just how it was coming off. And then they started saying, no, this is what it really came off like. And it showed me two things. First of all, it showed me this is why in the 2012 election, even when a lot of the polling showed much tighter election and a lot of good things, it broke late for the Democrats. Usually it breaks late for against the incumbent, and it did
right.
not. And I don't believe that this Tuesday night, I think we'll take the Senate, but barely. Some people are saying 53 seats. No way. And I don't think so. I mean, I hope so. But I think a lot of it's going to break late for the Democrats again due to this emotional connection.
Mm-hmm.
Simple belief that we don't care about them. I have a couple things I say to voters like that, but I'd rather JD comment first because.
Oh well, I just wanted to point out that this article was written by DC McAllister, as you said before, who was also the author of that other article on conservatives addressing women, and we were not really such fans of that one. So it's an interesting piece. I don't know how much stock I put into it personally. I'm always wary of focus groups. I'm always wary of small sample sizes and, you know, extrapolated data. That's something that terrifies me. It's something that makes me uneasy with the piece as a whole. So I mean, reading through it, it paints a bleak picture, but I'm not really sure how much faith I have in it.
Well, when I'm talking to not just female voters, but young voters, which I think are also very similar.
Yes.
I'll usually say something along these lines. You know why it's hard to get, you know, because let's say there's an election coming up, right? And you're in the break room or you're somewhere where you congregate. And I'll say, you know why it's hard to get excited about elections and voting and all that? And they'll be like, what? Why? And I'll say, because, you know, I'll make my choice, but it doesn't go anywhere unless a majority out of these millions of other people agree with it. I need a majority of millions of people to agree with me to get my way. I get excited about choices I can make. I choose to buy this car. I choose to buy that meal at Taco Bell. I choose to buy this. I choose to go here today. I get excited about my choices that don't rely on other people. So I guess when it comes to politics, I like whichever side leaves the most choices up to me and doesn't make me as dependent on government where I need because everything where I'm dependent on government, I need a majority of other people to let me get my way. And that's about, because I think the one reason they feel helpless or they don't care about voting or whatever is because their vote carries so little weight, but your vote as a consumer carries tremendous weight. You instantly get what you want or what you can have and so forth. You're not reliant on others. You feel so empowered instantly as a consumer and you're not empowered as a voter. And so I kind of try to emphasize that.
I like that. I like that. That's a good way to turn it around and to take their reluctance about caring about voting in there, to take their innate skepticism about the importance of their vote and compare it to the innate lack of influence that they have over big government and to say, see how much you think it's useless to vote. It's useless to do anything when you have this big of a government. So what we're working at is getting a smaller government. So if you actually vote with us towards that end, then government gets smaller and your vote becomes more important, because we're talking about your vote being in the free market and where everything you purchase is a vote. So you're kind of tying it all together.
Well, like, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's good. Go.
Another good example is school board elections. You know, I'll just look at them and say, don't you wish we didn't have to do these? I mean, the only reason we have to vote on school boards at all is because we're fighting to get 51% of the vote to do it our way instead of some other person's way. If we could all just choose where we put our kids in schools, then the schools would compete for us and our kids, and we wouldn't be voting on any school boards, because we wouldn't be voting on how to make other people's kids learn like our kids.
You know? Or other people's tax dollars spend like we want them to.
Right.
Most of the school board elections in our area center around who's the biggest bond booster.
Right. You know, I mean, wouldn't it be great if you didn't even have to vote on this stuff? Well, you wouldn't have to if your vote alone dictated where your child learns, where your tax dollar goes. See, that's the beauty of not having to vote on these things. That's the ugly of having government run things. Every time government runs something and gives you that quote-unquote security in that area, it comes with the price tag of now you've got to get 51% of the vote every 2 years to get it done your way.
And you can only give them feedback every 2 years.
Yeah, and
go. If it's the free market, you give people feedback immediately every day.
Yeah, you know. Leslie, another perfect example. Let's say you're at a Taco Bell, as I always bring up because I like it there.
Love Taco Bell.
Yeah, and what if they, you know, you ordered a steak, some steak burrito, and these horrifying people give you a chicken burrito? I would shoot them, but you know, I'm just very well. Actually, I wouldn't because I don't own a gun that has bullets. But if you don't like what they give you, what can you do?
You pull out of the drive-thru. You go right around the front. You walk in and you say, "Can I speak to the manager?" Or, "I ordered and this is what I got." You complain immediately.
Right. You walk up to the counter. You don't have to fall before school boards. You don't have to write letters to congressmen that are never returned. You don't have to get 51% of the vote. You don't have to go begging to anybody, including your fellow citizens, to, oh, please, 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 vote with me. You don't have to walk neighborhoods. You don't have to do all this stuff. You just go back and say, that's not what I ordered. Isn't it wonderful to be a consumer? That's how you take their apathy and turn it into aggression against
people. Well, Republican, if you love Taco Bell.
Oh, my God.
I am all over that.
Okay. I do want to bring up something that came in the article that I thought was irritating to me, and J.D. called BS on it in terms of whether it was actually true or just a made-up sort of thing. But this does remind me of another article that we've talked about before. The author is saying that she talked to one woman, a single mom, age 51, with three children in Charlotte, recently lamented to me that she doesn't know what's going on in the election. I encouraged her to read about it. She sighed, saying she just didn't have time. "Sure you do," I said. She shrugged. "You're right, but I just don't really want to know. No one says anything positive anyway. It's all so depressing." And then she says, with this mean little statement, I think, she left after our conversation to do yoga and then head to the movies to see Gone Girl for the third time. Okay, now regardless of the truth or fiction of this account, the deal is that there are voters who will get to this point in an election and say, "If only I knew the positions of the people on the ballot."
Mm-hmm.
And they might not go all the way down the ballot, but there's no excuse, really, for a person not knowing what the senator candidates or the governor candidates believe. The information's out there. And in ACE, they addressed this a couple of years ago in 2012, talking about how the candidates, Romney especially, needed to release like a 30-minute video just talking about what he was about. And he said nobody'd actually watch it, but you advertise that you've done it, and then people will say, oh, yeah, well, he's put his positions out there. And we do that in the form of 5-minute videos or whatever, and we think that's good. But they were saying, you know, voters get to this point, and they say they're undecided, but I even Frank Luntz is sometimes amazed at the number of people that say they're undecided at this point. It's really people who don't want to tip their hand or who like to be courted or want to feel like they're considering all the issues when they're not doing any such thing. I just wanted to call back to that article because I think that this article bringing that up is sort of a consistent strain. And we do need to have a strategy to deal with people who just don't want to know.
Well, I mean, see, that's something that drives me nuts. And I'm not really sure that this just don't want to know voter actually votes. I mean, that's something that I'm not certain that exists. But it just, to me, a lot of it is couching. A lot of it is not wanting to let people know what it is that they're thinking. I mean, that to me, I think that's a large part of a lot of these focus groups. So that's why I have a hard time dealing with them because there's going to be a part of the focus groups that aren't going to be answering truthfully, that aren't going to be answering honestly, and are going to go along with what the next person in line said, as opposed to what they actually believe. I mean, there's a lot of stuff here that I don't think is kosher. If we are talking about somebody who legitimately doesn't want to know, then all we can do is, as Andy said, just go in and try and explain why they should want to know. But you know, it's going back to that whole you can bring a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. There are going to be some people that are not going to want to know this stuff, that are just going to bypass the election and not vote. And those people are out there. Sadly, there are a lot of them out there. So, you know, I don't really see that particular demographic. I see them as people that we should try to get, but not people that we should lose sleep over, because chances are they are not going to be voting for anyone, let alone, you know, vote for us. That's just my opinion on it.
So I have a thought that I saw today. I saw a post today by Marla Hughes, and it was for people who think they don't have time or don't know where to go to get their politics, but they do want to learn a little bit before the election. It says, go to Google search, type in your zip code, your city and state, add the word ballot. All of the issues and candidates will pop up so you can search each one. So I haven't tried it. I don't know how well it works, but that's a very simple way for people who do kind of want to know but don't have time to study, you know, don't want to get that into it, but they do want to be somewhat informed when they go to vote. We can direct people to do something like that.
And that's a very good thing, and I saw that link as well. Part of it also is that there are an awful lot of people who are not going to comment on politics. They're not going to acknowledge that they have a point of view because they don't want to get into the discussion, because they don't feel that they know enough to have the discussion. So claiming to be uninformed, claiming to be undecided is a way of avoiding the discussion, and I respect that too. A reason that Democrats tend to win is because if you're avoiding politics, just like Rob is saying here in chat, he doesn't have a television, he doesn't listen to chat radio. On all of his web surfing, he's got ad blocker. So really the only stuff he sees is the stuff he wants to see by intention. So it's, if he doesn't go out and seek political information, it's not going to land on his desk. And so the only political messages he hears are liberal ones, because liberal political messages are in your sports cast, and they're in all of the entertainment you do. They're in the songs that you listen to. They're in the non-political articles that you read. They're, if you read just about science, you're reading liberal science. And it's because the Democrats are all politics all the time, everywhere. If you go to a classical music concert, the conductor is going to, at intermission, speak his liberal politics, and then he'll go on and continue with Vivaldi or whatever.
Well, of course, because you can't have Vivaldi. You can't have seasons if there's global warming.
Correct. That's exactly you caught the link. Brilliant. And they will do that without shame, without remorse, and without feeling the least bit inappropriate about it, whereas we tend to keep our politics separate from our other topics. We don't mix the two. So for the people who don't go out and look for political topic stuff, they never hear conservative messaging. All the liberal messaging goes unopposed because we're not where they are.
Let's remember, too, that we do want to be that influential person in those people's lives so that we're at least able to get messaging into their feeds, and we are the person they turn to that knows things about politics. I get why it's so intimidating. And really, when I started, I didn't want to become an expert in things like the water rain tax in Houston or the rainy day fund in Texas. Or, you know, nationally, things like, Obamacare or any of that. I didn't want to have to learn all of those things. And people need to remember that the reason there is so much to know about politics is because government is in freaking everything you do. Right. And there's so much to know because government is so big. When you were concerned, 100 years ago or 150 years ago, with what was going on in your little town, and you had most of the power centered there, you could look the guys in the eye who were planning to do things and deal with them. This is government by, growing by leaps and bounds, and there's no way to keep up with it. So those of us who do keep up with it have that responsibility to talk to people because there's just so much, and it makes the point. Every time they say there's just too much to know, I can't keep up. That's where you say, then listen to my advice, please, and vote for some less government so that there's less for you to worry about.
Well, that's why we try to simplify it to, I want to control my own life, not yours. And keep it something simple that they can relate to, and then show how that can be applied in every area of government intertwining with their lives. One huge disadvantage we have on the right is that emotions only take one step to understand. Intellect takes two. For instance, the left can basically say, vote for us, we'll give you these things. Okay, it takes your intellect to understand the next step of those things come from others who employ you. Okay, those things come from others. The second step, every dollar that comes to you via government has to be taken from the private sector where jobs are created that pay for government. Okay, well, that's an argument. That is a, and then, of course, there's so much more you can say after that. The emotional thing only takes one image to present. The intellectual argument always takes two, three, four images to present. So you have to first hook them to wanting to hear the intellectual argument. And that's the challenge.
The article I shared really just goes off what Andy just said. The article I wanted to talk about is from Jonah Goldberg on Real Clear Politics website, and it's called The Power of Narrative. He starts out talking about the difference between ideas and narratives. He shares a quote by Victor Hugo that says, "There is one thing stronger than all the armies in the world. That is an idea whose time has come." On to say, maybe so, but the only reason an idea's time ever arises is that some story gives birth to it. Every lesson you've ever learned came at the end of a story, either one you lived or one you watched unfold. All the great religions are taught to us as stories. Every great journalistic expose came in the form of a story. And the stories have the power to hook us. Like Andy was saying, they get us interested, they get us wanting to know more. And we learn those ideas through stories, not the other way around. Towards the
end, a lot of the history that I know is because I started by reading a fictional history book because I was a teenage girl, and you know that's what teenage girls do. It would be a fiction story set in some particular era, and I would be fascinated about that era, and I would learn more about that era because of the stories. So yeah, story is everything.
Yeah. So then he gives a few examples of stories. I want to talk about the one he ends with. Similarly, so much that passes for ideological opposition to capitalism is in reality loyalty to a storyline disproved by reality. Indeed, one reason climate change hysteria is so hard to combat is that, unlike previous indictments of capitalism, it is immune to falsification. If temperatures rise or if they fall, it's evidence of impending calamity. For generations, we were told that democratic capitalism was bad for environment compared with the enlightened rule of socialism. But everywhere this proposition was put to the test, it failed. I understand that the difference between narratives and ideas can be a subtle one, but if you keep the distinction in mind, the arguments tearing apart America become more comprehensible. It is a conflict of visions driven by adherence of two versions of the story of America. And whichever side wins, the victors will determine the story taught to the next generation. Right now, the left is great at telling stories. We mention it all the time that they are good at movies, comedy. They have the newspapers. They have most mediums of entertainment out there. They almost have a monopoly on. They're very good at, and we're just starting to learn that stuff and play catch up. We need to get a lot better at telling stories, and like as Andy said, appealing to emotions. People do vote on emotions. They are swayed by emotions. If we tell good stories to illustrate truths, we can get to their emotions, and we can hopefully have an influence, get them more interested in studying the real, studying what's really true, and get them interested in learning more for themselves. JD has a video queued up here that I saw recently, and Leslie posted earlier today, and it has some black men in it, and they are telling their stories. They're telling about why the black rule in cities like Detroit is hurting black people and that it's time for change. So I'm going to mute myself and let JD go with that video now.
Black folks is in an abusive black leadership relationship.
We have to send a message. This is the time for us to send a message.
We're always talking about what the Republicans ain't done for us or what they will do to hurt us. My life has been hurt by Democrats.
And we got in our mind that we always got to vote for Democrats.
Look and see in your community, who are the real oppressors in our community? They always talk about black on black crime. And when you hear the word black on black crime, the first thing you think of is a black man robbing you, a black man breaking in your house. And that is a black on black crime. But let's take it one step further. Black on black crime down in all the state capitals in America, where black folks are voting against our interests, where black folks are voting and making us, we're getting poorer and poorer, and other groups are getting richer and richer.
Everywhere you go, there's poverty in black areas.
This is why I'm saying it right now. How to be real. Public housing, where they used to live at. Most of the people are homeless living in the street. And it's because of you, Mr. President.
In Detroit, where your leaders at? There's no white folks running Detroit, cutting water on black folks in Detroit. Them black folks running that city. Ain't no white folks doing that. Them black folks going along with that. Everything's happening in our community is black leadership doing this.
Our children know that if the Democrats have not done anything for us as of yet, why should they even go out and vote? What agenda is on the table that's going to change their life?
The only thing they offer in the black community is abortion on demand. This is what the president asking for us to vote for.
Now he wants to have this conversation about minimum wage raise because he knows that this is the way to get a lot of the poor people's attention. But the hell with his minimum wage raise. We don't have any jobs. A minimum wage raise for what?
They're not pushing a black agenda. They're not pushing a family agenda. They're pushing a neoliberal agenda.
Across this city in these major Democratic cities, this is what it looks like.
How can the same process happen over and over again and nobody got nothing, can't do nothing about it?
Black leadership is abusing us. The Democratic Party is abusing us.
It's the same way in every black community across the country.
And they force us into a life of welfare. We don't want no welfare. We want opportunities to go to work. We want opportunities to own all of the major banks and these big investors, but left the people starving.
There are no tea parties in your city.
We don't have those people. We have a major Democratic machine, and the majority of them, they look like me. These are the people who make sure we get nothing, but then turn around and have us to vote for them again.
They only come around when it's time for elections. When they think they can give you a toy or give you a turkey or something, and everything is good.
Hundreds of millions of dollars are coming down from the federal government. But the money is going to all these special interest groups. My brother's keeper went to his friends. This whole corrupt democratic system that gobbles up all the dollars and starves the people out. Can you all look around your community and see any change that'll come about with these hundreds of billions of dollars that'll come through our cities? No, you cannot. What we do see is our elected officials riding around in new cars, and they have new homes.
When our people don't have jobs in our communities, when we don't have any vital resources, when all the deals been cut and all our people are left out, this is where we end up.
And we got the most important thing that we got that we can stop all this. Everybody got to vote. And if you use your vote wisely, you can stop a lot of this stuff.
I think that's a great example of telling a story, telling how it's impacted their lives, and also giving solutions on what they can do differently. Another example of storytelling, I saw Leslie post a few days ago her insurance cancellation from Obamacare. They're sending out other rounds now, and as we get those, we should all share our story of this is how we got the... Yep, this is my insurance cancellation. They told me I'd be able to keep my insurance. I like my insurance, and I can't. Sorry, I forgot. I want to really quick give Rebel Pundit a thank you for that clip. It's very well done. I really enjoyed it. So go check out their site. Give them
some. Well, you might not know, if I'm not mistaken, Rebel Pundit is the one who hijacked an Occupy rally in Chicago back when Occupy was going. Rebel Pundit is something else.
I thought it was really terrific, and the thing I liked the most was when he said that, you know, we look at Detroit, there aren't any Republicans running Detroit. This has all been run by Democrats. And look at how bad it is here, and it's this way in all black communities across the country. I love how they called attention to the fact, hey, our party is running all the worst places in the nation where we live, where we're stuck. The only thing I wish that was missing, because I loved how it showed the end result of voting Democrat, I wish it had mentioned just something along the way, some kind of economic reality of why Democrat policies bring that about. But that would have, you know, not a lot. I prefer to emphasize on the story and where we are and where it winds up. But, you know, just something about, you know, when you kill investment like this, you know, when people can't invest, when they can't unleash, when they can't freely create, this is what you get. I don't know. I'm not sure. That was the only thing that was missing to me, was something that shows why you get from A to C, not just saying, you know, we're at A, we'll wind up at C every time with this vote.
And I think the key to that video, and in the short time that video has been on the internet, it's been shared and liked an awful lot, and it's sparking some really good, thoughtful conversation, which is amazing. And I guess it's the credibility that the participants in the video have in what they're saying, and that you can't really criticize what they're saying, and you can't really make the typical accusations of, well, that's just, you know, racist Republicans saying their same thing. These guys are saying some really hard truths, and they're like Andy said, they're saying the Republicans aren't here. The Tea Party isn't here. And we got all these hundreds of millions of dollars, and are you seeing it in your town? These hundreds of million dollars came in, and they went to a relative of the Brothers Keeper guy. The Brothers Keeper guy got his $100 million share, and he gave the money to all of his friends. He didn't leave it in the neighborhood. He and all of his friends are driving fancy cars. And that, you know, the guys who look just like me that are running our neighborhoods, they're getting rich and we're getting poorer. That was a really important message, I thought, and I think people are maybe starting to get it.
You know, one of the things that I've always anticipated us coming up against, and it eventually did happen, but from the beginning of the Tea Party, when we talked about making government smaller, and then you look at the proportion of minorities employed by government versus as a portion of the population, and there's a higher percentage employed in government work, mm-hmm. that the argument would be made, and eventually it was, that shrinking government is a racist proposition in and of itself. Simply because
so many minorities are government workers, so if you shrink government, you fire government workers, and you're firing minorities.
Right, and this video didn't even touch on that anywhere near that, but think about the power of a lot of that narrative that's been embedded in those cities from liberal politicians who want to expand government by saying that will bring jobs, because they can point to a larger number of minorities who are hired by civic institutions or federal institutions and say, see, the federal government or the cities under Democrat control bring jobs. That's always been a hairy issue to deal with.
Yeah, but I'll tell you what, this video undercuts that by saying, here's the bottom line. Look at our neighborhood. Okay, this is what's left. We have most of those jobs. Now, here's the bottom line. Look at our neighborhood overall. This is what that gets us. That's all there is to it. And it's not like this is what gets us, that this is what that gets us for now. This is what that's gotten us for decades. Okay. Right. This is proven and reproven and reproven and reproven again. I do want to pose one question to the crowd here. How do you deal with the comeback, though? That's because Republicans have left, are keeping the big money out of our communities. They're keeping they move the companies out of here so they don't have to deal with the union. You know, they move their companies to Mexico or they move them to another state. They build in states that are not union friendly. They draw money out. It's the Republicans who left the inner cities and took their money with them.
And your question is, how do we deal with that narrative?
Yeah, what would you say?
I would ask Andy what he has to say for that.
It's a total of garbage.
You're asking who?
No. It's a total garbage narrative. I'd just like to hear what you guys would have to say to it.
I think that the response to that is that it's not just big businesses that are leaving. It's small businesses that are leaving. It's any kind of business. I mean, you can't survive in that climate. It's like having somebody, try and have a small business on the moon. There's nobody, you can't breathe. It's not something that you're capable of doing. You can't run a successful business in a climate that is inhospitable. It just doesn't happen. So and this is something that's actually relevant to me, because I live in a county that has some urban areas in it that definitely have been left by Republicans at some point in time. But the message that needs to go out there is that, hey, we're here now. We're here to try and help now. We want to see what we can do to help get everybody back on their feet. We want to try and get the economy up and running and get the climate right for jobs and make things better in that area. I mean, to me, that's the approach that you have to have.
Well, and we have this typical look of when we're looking at bringing business to an area, and you can see this in Texas with the Enterprise Fund. We talk about large corporations bringing union jobs. I mean, this is sort of, or, you know, in the case of Texas, just manufacturing or, you know, support of manufacturing jobs. The problem is that when you only have a large business-based set of industries and jobs, those support jobs may or may not come along behind. You may have, you know, stores that have to be built when you bring those in. But if one of those pulls out, all of the underlying businesses that depended upon that industry, which is practically a series of company stores when you get down to it, all of those collapse and fold too. So when we talk about business and we talk about, you know, companies leaving, if a big company leaves your town and kills it, your town was not healthy. I don't know how you explain that to people in saying, you know, if you have the ability to kill a town by moving the largest employer out, you have a problem. I think that's something that has to be dealt with, the expectation that you only get jobs from large corporations.
I always use the $10, $10 million thing. I say, oh, they left because they're just like you. See, they left because they're exactly like you. If you got 10 bucks that you can spend on some fast food, are you going to go to the place that gives you the least amount of food and it's the worst prepared? Or are you going to go to the place that gives you the best bang for the buck, the place where the food tastes better, you get more, it's what? Where are you going to go with your 10 bucks? And they're going to say, well, I'm going to go over here. And I'm going to say, oh, well, you see, these big businesses, because we're talking about big corporations, they can go anywhere with their money because they've got to sell their cars or whatever. They don't just sell them in Detroit. They got to sell them all over the world. This is a global economy. And they got to compete with other people who sell that same product, you see? And so they can go anywhere with that $10 million and plop down that factory, and you guys are making it the most expensive place in labor, the most expensive place in government oversight, the most expensive place in taxes, the most expensive place. They're not getting near the bang for the buck. And here's the worst thing. With your 10 bucks, at least you're not having to compete with somebody else's 10 bucks. You get to just go, everybody else is competing for your 10 bucks. You just go and get what you want. But with them, not only do they got to get the best bang for their buck, but they can't even try and be charitable and not get the best bang, because they got to create a car at a comparable price to this factory in Korea. All right, you drove them away, and not you, okay? Because it started before you were here in Detroit. You drove them away by making everything more expensive, and they had to leave just as you would leave that fast food place that didn't give you the better deal than the three that are near it in the area. They're just like you.
Fishy, I think that you should make that point on the air about Detropia.
Oh, right. Well, last year I saw a documentary that was created a few years ago called Detropia. You can find it on Netflix. It's a fascinating look at the problems that Detroit's faced, some of the, you know, I guess, bohemian renaissance that's happening. Not so much a focus on the libertarian efforts and community there, the private sector efforts that have been there, but artists and people like that moving and into Detroit because it's affordable and because they can create interesting things, and there's not so much watching over the government because they just can't afford to do it and they're taking risks. But it's also walking through things like an auto show where one of the guys there who owns a bar is looking at all these cars, and he sees an electric car from an American producer, an electric car from a Japanese producer or a South Korean producer, and he's comparing prices and he's comparing features, and he goes back to the American folks, the American manufacturing folks, and starts talking about, why can't you build this car for that? And gets all this, you know, well, it's American, it's better, blah, blah, blah. But nothing substantive, but it's that moment where he's saying to them, realizing, you can't get people to buy this when they can buy that. It's a powerful documentary. It's about an hour long. It just shows the ruin and the renaissance at the same time. And doesn't leave you, I mean, it leaves you hanging. It leaves you with a what is going to happen to Detroit question. I recommend that for people too. It's a very powerful narrative there, just the story of Detroit.
I'll definitely watch it. Well, Mitt Romney put it best. He said the same car in Detroit costs between $2,200 and $2,500 more to make than overseas. Same car. The exact same car. You know, and he knows Detroit. I mean, he knows Michigan and this kind of thing. So it's unbelievable. But like I said, I just look at people and say, hey, you try to get the best deal for your buck, but you don't want them to. So what you're counting on to save your city is a lot of people acting not like you. That's your goal. How about you doing for them what you want these fast food places to do for you? Otherwise, you're going to have Detropia, is what you're going to have. I mean, because that's what they want. They want utopia. They want it paid for by everybody else. Guess what? Other people leave.
Is there a non-snarky or non-smart-ass way to say, well, I don't know what came first, the chicken or the egg, but the inner cities are poverty-stricken and being abandoned, and they are very concentrated Democrat inner cities, and the successful people in the middle and upper incomes are out in the suburbs, and they're conservatives. So if you want to be upper, if you want to be middle class, try being conservative, see what happens. You know, because which came first, being conservative or being successful? But they do seem to be inextricably linked.
Honestly, okay, conservatism as a political philosophy, I don't think it's in taken into account really heavily in what you're talking about, that white flight or you know, suburban sprawl phenomenon. What you're getting is people with conservative values, which is different from conservative political ideology,
right,
who want to be left alone. They want to live in a space with land, a little bit of grass to mow. They want to be able to park their car in a garage that's theirs, not necessarily park on a street. They want to go to the store and not have to worry about the 17 times in the past 10 years that place has been robbed. And where you congregate a lot of people, you have more social problems, and they're fleeing that. That's conservative values at play. That's not conservative political ideology. I think that's a keen difference that needs to be denoted.
True, very good point. And there's a point here about homeowners associations. And yes, many people move out into the suburbs, into neighborhoods that have strong, really tight homeowners associations. I did that by choice, and it's a small organization. It's my neighborhood. So the rules and regulations are made by people in my neighborhood that I know. They're my neighbors, and I can join the homeowners association and have an effect on that. It's not living inside the city limits and being victimized by the vote of the rain tax and the fact that everybody now has to have the monster size garbage things because you have the automated garbage pickup that's out at your curb rather than your homeowners association deciding to have garbage pickup that's up your driveway so you don't actually have garbage cans all out on the street. You know, it's I'm choosing strong regulations, but on the smallest level, not at the level of the city, not at the level of the county, the state, or the feds, but at the level of my neighborhood. And that in that actually is a conservative value. It's not a conservative. It's not conservative political party. It's not Republicanism. It's a conservative value of having the decisions made as close to the people who live with those with the results of those decisions as possible.
Another thing I don't think we take into account is people who can do for themselves and who have done for themselves, they really want to be left alone. But people who have need of a safety net, they need to live in more concentrated communities. They need to be in places where they can swap favors and whatever. I mean, that harkens back to Megan McArdle and the talk about...
the economy, yeah, that... trading economy that she was talking
about. Yes, that political capital, I mean that different kind of capital, social capital that's out there. And so what conservatives do once they get out of a city or once they leave that area, people who are doing better, they're not looking back. They don't have any more responsibility to that, the place that they left, that mess. And why would you ask them to, as a matter of paying for things involuntarily? Now, if they had charitable desires and feelings in their heart, they could rush in and do all kinds of things. And that's what's happening in Detroit, too. People who do make sacrifices so they can help others, or they develop a business that employs people who were previously unemployed. You know, that sort of thing is far different from just trying to, say, expand your city limits so you can grab more suburban tax dollars.
Well, what do you let's get real totally negative here. What do you say about the inner city voter and leaders when they group together and they are not even trying to paint a pretty face on it? They just basically say, there are more of us. We're going to have more kids. We're going to outnumber the people in the sticks, outvote them, and take their money. We're going to elect politicians who are simply going to redirect money from the wealthy to us, from the countryside to us, from the suburbs to us, from everywhere to us. And we're going to suck it up because there's more of us. And what are you going to do about it? What do you say to that?
Well, sadly, they don't say that in those words, those terms too often.
But what you do say is you tell conservatives to have a lot of babies.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
Thank God for Mormons. That's all I have to say. That's it. We just need to export Utah everywhere. I'm sure that'll work. That's the thing. That's us trying to push our theological agenda in America. So we're back to being a theocracy.
But hey, that reminds, don't you remember Ryan's article that he posted not too long ago? It was like a 4-page article about, you know, what they were doing, poverty programs for people in Utah versus in, I think, Washington State. It was striking, the difference.
Yeah,
and that's because they care and they have the opportunity and the means to do it.
What's the matter with Utah, though, for crying out loud? Californians export and move everywhere. In Utah, they just stay there. I think that's really selfish.
Yeah, it is. In fact, They've gone galt. The entire state of Utah. That's it.
Yeah, we live in a horrible place. It's ugly here, and it's cold all year round. And you come visit for ski season, but you definitely don't want to stay here.
Yeah, Ryan, that mission requirement, y'all need to make that, like, missionary work to move other places. Yeah, do that.
And vote.
A lot.
And vote.
Yeah, could you guys do missions to Colorado for voting purposes?
Yeah, because out here you can vote early and often and over and over and over again, and no one will know.
I'm just telling you.
The Democrats have a monopoly on that right now.
You can learn.
It's easy.
We just watched a video on how to do it. I mean, if you need,
yeah.
We'll send it to you.
Yeah, James.
Oh my God. The Mormons are going to take over the country, and everybody will be happy and better for it.
Oh, my God, it'll turn us into Canada. Everybody's going to be all polite and nice and helpful and hardworking and stuff.
Look, I just voted
for help us.
I just voted for a Mormon for president. Would have loved it.
Me too.
Well, we did talk about this We did talk about this on a different show on Saturday. I think that was this week about certain cultures being a little bit better than others from time to time. But I don't know. It's a fun path to walk down. But geez, I don't know that we could handle a whole nation of Mormons. That would just be really really difficult dealing with Ryan all the time.
And we'd have to give up our coffee, and that's so not going to happen.
I don't drink coffee.
And I can't go into, you know, my Taco Bell unless Ryan vouches for me.
I don't think that's how it'll work.
I think it will. I'm already a little worried.
Yeah. Well, there was almost a segue into our next topic, and that was government seizure of property because they can, and that's been in the news a bit lately. Couple of different stories about that, and they kind of tie together and relate. And because of the cold medicine I'm on, I'm only remembering one, which is, okay, no, wait, got them both. The IRS seizure of accounts that it's suspicious of because of the $10,000 cash. Let's see, there's the I guess RICO laws or whatever they are that doesn't let you take out or deposit or withdraw $10,000 in cash without reporting it from your bank to the federal government. And so then there's a store who does a lot of business in cash, and her day's receipts are somewhere, you know, in the vicinity of $10,000, a little bit south of that, and she deposits every day a little bit less than $10,000. Well, the bank, because the bank didn't want to get audited by the IRS, the bank is overly aggressive in their reporting of suspicious accounts. So the bank reported her to the feds. So then the IRS goes in and they seize this store's accounts. No warning, no warrant, no nothing. They just seize her bank accounts. And now this woman she's in trouble. She can't run her business. And it's all because they thought that they needed to maybe look at some possibility of considering somebody who has a pattern of behavior that is sort of like guys who tend to be criminals. And because of all of that, they, without judge's permission, without warrant, without warning, without filing any charges, without even coming close to filing any charges, they seize her bank accounts. And these are, you know, the feds and I think local governments too can seize property, and then the victim, citizen victim, has to file suit and file paperwork and all of this kind of stuff to try to recover their own property. And one of the really shocking things I saw in this article was even if you win and get your property back, they keep a percentage of it. Even if this improperly seized private property that was seized by the government without permission, even if it's proven that they had no right and no reason to seize your property and they have to give it back, they don't pay your legal costs, and they keep a percentage of your property just because they can.
And this is what's so onerous about it, too. The citizen, the person whose property has been confiscated, has the burden of proof.
Right.
Nowhere else in law is that applicable. But you have to prove you didn't do what they suspect you of. There's no such thing as due process in that. Not at all. And every congressman, every senator ought to be on this and talking about stories like this. But this isn't a sexy issue for them because, hey, that means we don't have to allocate so much for that agency. They're just going to rake their own in. And this happens at the county level when we talk about drug seizures and sheriff departments actually confiscating people's houses because of suspicion that someone was dealing out of that house, or stealing, confiscating someone's car because it might, they think, maybe have been used to transport narcotics or something like this. And I don't see how, if your nephew, say, is involved in the drug trade and borrows your car and you are unaware of that first fact and you willingly let him use the car, how you become an accessory to that, which is what they're treating you like, except there's no trial. This is an issue that conservatives, Republicans, libertarians, and everybody on the rightward end of the spectrum, plus plenty of people on the leftward end of the spectrum, should be able to get behind. And this should be an issue that resonates with everybody. And we can definitely start finding and moving more of these stories. I'm glad this is hitting social media now, but it comes up and then it goes away. It comes up and then it goes away. When we talk about moving the cultural needle, we have to make these things stick. And that is what I want to see coming out of this story.
Absolutely, because it is, we've got a very powerful narrative, like Ryan was talking about earlier. These are stories that have sad faces. We have closed businesses. We have fired employees because the government overreached, the government exceeded their authority, the government sought money and funding that was beyond what was allocated to them via legal taxation. And this is a government out of control, government that needs to be stopped. It needs to be starved. And if it's going to take 5% across the board sequestration cuts that everybody screams about, I'm kind of okay with that. And if that means that some friends of mine end up unemployed, I'm okay with that. If they have skills, they will find other jobs. And we have to be...
I was just going to say, maybe I'm confused here, but I kind of thought that we had this thing called the Fourth Amendment that protected against these kinds of unreasonable searches and seizures. I mean, that's
right.
Kind of sounds unreasonable.
You have to go through the
isn't
process.
This
is extra legal. This isn't even in the process by which you have rights that are attributed to you. They just taken it. Just are taking it. And it's outside of a court case. Your due process is when you go in and fight it. That's what they're calling it. That's the reasonable part, is that they've deemed you're a threat and you prove you're not. Now, why we don't have lawyers on the right that are on this all the time, 24/7, making this a big stink, I don't know, except that how hard is it to hold government accountable for misdeeds like this? How hard is it for the conservatives to make this case when the law has been interpreted or written specifically to do this?
Yes,
I don't know, but we really should get some lawyers on this. I wish I knew where we could find some lawyers. Maybe if we bought some more books.
You're a lawyer.
Lawyers would be able to.
You wrote the book.
Would be able to work on this stuff.
I would really like to hear his opinions on that, actually. I think we need to hit him up for some interview time on this especially.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because regular people like me are wondering, how the hell are they getting away with this? How is this even legal? How is it that this shop owner, this lady, and I'm looking at her picture right now, she's like trying to cook something. She looks like, my aunt. I mean, she's just a nice, kindly old lady. How is it that she's having a hard time proving that she's right? How is it that the IRS is getting away with this? And this isn't new. This isn't the result of some new law that was just passed. This is the IRS using and becoming worse about stuff they've been doing to lots of people.
The great thing about this is that this article is appearing in the New York Times, and that's a huge thing, because that's not, nobody can be considering that source partisan toward conservatives or anything like that. And in no way can they be classified libertarian or anything. So it's getting into a broader audience than it otherwise would have gotten, which is huge.
Right.
And we have groups, I think Landon mentioned in chat, was it Landon?
Was it George?
I think that Families Against Mandatory Minimums and Right on Crime have been pushing this issue. Reason has been talking about cases like this. there are many more organizations who should be on this bandwagon, and this should be a massive push from the rightward end of the spectrum. And I say that because I don't want to – conservatives should, liberals should, libertarians should, Republicans should. I just say the rightward end of the spectrum. If you find yourself leaning more toward liberty, this is where you – this is an issue you should be focused on.
Well, I think a big problem is that it's not widely known. I mean, thank goodness this is in the New York Times, because now it's raising awareness to an issue that has been going on that most people haven't ever heard about. One thing that I see in business is that it's similar to, they're called as cheat laws, where a company isn't allowed to withhold funds. Even if you don't know where that customer lives, if you owe them money, you're only allowed to hold it for so long before you're told that you have to turn it over to the state's unclaimed property. Okay, that way the state can find that person and they can get their property back to them. Sounds great. But what the states are doing now is they're actually targeting companies and going after them and doing these massive audits, looking at everything they can get their hands on, and then the auditors are getting a cut of the funds that they are saying should have been sent over to the state but weren't. So right then and there, that's similar to this story, because it sounded to me like the agents were getting a cut of the funds from that poor woman and her business. You know, that's a huge conflict of interest right there, and I don't know anybody, no matter what their political background is, unless they're extreme hard leftist, who's going to be okay with that?
Right, right. And I think, too, stressing the single-person shops, the small businesses that this has happened to, that, you know, 15 and under employees or 30 and under employees or something like that, that is where you're going to make the real, I guess, juice behind this that's going to go. We can't be talking about, you know, some large – well, and we wouldn't really be talking about larger corporations. They have mechanisms to deal with this. This is – disproportionately hurting the poor, the small business people, the cash-only business people. Typically in certain neighborhoods and especially urban environments, people deal almost exclusively in cash. And this is hurting those people. Being able to show it and put those faces on it, individuals like the grandma that's got the sweet face and cooking something, that's what we need. If we're going to use the narrative, let's use people that will rip your guts out when you hear their stories.
Yeah.
Well, and it's true, the forfeiture of the unclaimed funds forfeiture that you're talking about, we have a tendency to appreciate the free market aspect of the person who goes after and finds it gets a percentage of the profit. We understand that debt collectors, when you turn over your debt to bill collectors, that the bill collector is going to keep a percentage of the money that they are able to collect before turning it over to the person who had who held the original debt. We understand and appreciate that from a free market perspective in terms of collecting legitimate debts. But the rules that apply in the free market should not apply in the government. And the government paying a bounty for seizure of other people's property, that's so improper, I can't even see straight.
Well, right, because, for instance, Andy and I had to hire a collection agency one time, and we knew ahead of time exactly what it was that the collection agency was going to be going after. Mm-hmm. We knew exactly what their fees were going to be. We knew exactly how the fees would escalate after a certain amount of time. We signed a contract for that.
Right.
There was to it. However, with what this is doing is that they're saying, they're sending in these agents or these auditors, and they're saying, you guys just dig until you find as much as you possibly can. And also the laws are stacked against the company. Whether it's a huge corporation or it's a little mom and pop shop, if you're told that you have to prove yourself innocent just against an accusation when there's no evidence or proof that you've done nothing wrong, or maybe you just made a mistake. Because goodness knows, with all the regulations that are out there, I'm sure we're all breaking rules all the time, every single day.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know? Sometimes you're just going to make an honest mistake. But when that can be used against you no matter what's the mom and pop shop to do?
And it's one thing to argue against a collection agency that is knocking on my door trying to collect a debt, and it's another thing entirely to attempt to go up against the government. who has the power of the gun and the power of forfeiture. I am not as powerful in fighting against my government as I am in fighting against a commercial enterprise.
Exactly, because the government is the one that makes the rules.
Right.
And Rob in chat makes a great point. He says the IRS is a government agency, and you can't punish a government agency by suing them. The only way this gets fixed is by agitating until the laws are changed. And that takes not just, you know, moving the cultural needle, but getting in the faces of legislators with those stories and saying, what are you going to do about this? If you find out that this is going on in your area, address it. If you have a state in which these kind of laws are being abused and used against people, make that a mission of yours.
Well, I'm about to have a brand new mission based on stories from the last 2 days. Felicia yesterday had to buy Sudafed, and it was a horrific experience. I today had to buy Sudafed, and it was a horrific experience. I'm standing in line. I'm giving my driver's license. Oh, my God, I had to have a driver's license. That was racist, wasn't it?
Yes.
I had to give them my driver's license, and it was recorded and written down, and I had to sign just to verify that I was legal to buy a package of Sudafed because allergies in Houston, Texas are horrific this year. And the pharmacist was distracted from her job of being able to take care of somebody who had questions about her prescription and needed the medical expertise of the pharmacist. I had to take up the pharmacist's time just so that she could sell me some cold medicine. And it would maybe be worthwhile if methamphetamine was no longer on the streets. But the law that made Sudafed illegal to buy has been completely ineffective, and it's hurt the sales of a bunch of pharmaceutical companies. It has taken up the time of a lot of pharmacists. It's inflicted pain on their process. It costs them money to handle the sales of these products, and it costs consumers. But is there any effort anywhere to repeal this dumb law?
I was thinking I just needed to find a Walter White and I can pay above market price for unconstructed meth so that I could just get the original raw material without having to stand in a line or offer my driver's license.
Right, right. Let's make a Sudafed lab. We'll go buy meth and construct the Sudafed out of it. We could probably get really rich if we started unmething things. I don't even know what I'm talking about, by the way. But
And the NSA is all over this right now. They're relaying this information that you're saying to the DEA. So you should expect the SWAT team in, you know, an hour.
Shall I say it? You know. Come and take it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're knocking on the door. Well, hold on a second. I'm going to go get the door. Yeah, whatever.
Nice Foley effects there.
Way to go, Fish.
I'm totally a Foley artist, yes.
There you are.
The time wasted to do this. Has anybody been able to see that it's paid off? Is this a Texas thing? I couldn't even tell from looking at the card that you have to go get in the aisle in order to take it to the pharmacy to buy the product. It didn't even tell you what the law was. Or which entity imposed the law?
I believe it's nationwide. And I think Texas is like more liberal than other states. I think there are some states where you can't even buy Sudafed at all.
So wait a second. What you're saying is that they put the Fed into Sudafed?
Oh,
JD. Okay, we need to calm down. Hold on. Man,
I thought that was good.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Thank you. But I just want to say, because I have to do it, I'm obligated to do it because I Googled it before. I was like, hey, you know, we're talking about these asset forfeitures. Didn't somebody have like a bill about that somewhere along the... Oh, yeah, it was Rand Paul who had a bill about that. And when I Googled Rand Paul and asset forfeiture, he apparently has an op-ed in Breitbart today, or yesterday, I should say, about his bill, the FAIR Act, which would make the forfeitures go through state law instead of federal law, and the assets forfeited go to the General Treasury Fund instead of the Attorney General's Asset Forfeiture Fund. So I'm going to put that into the chat, and I don't know, I'll be investigating that a little bit more going forward, but man.
That's one of those issues that we conservative, libertarian, rightward-leaning people can talk about and can promote without angering the theocrats that do exist on the conservative side, and without really angering the people who fear the theocrats. It's an issue that an awful lot of people will agree on and that we can get interest in, I would think.
I'm pretty sure we lost like 5 subscribers when you said theocrats, and then we lost another 5 subscribers when you said theocrats. So it's just like, we're joking. We're joking, people. Just stop. Right? Don't take it seriously.
Well, how many viewers did we lose when you said Rand Paul? But then again, I think we all committed heresy last week when we admitted that we don't worship at the altar of Rush Limbaugh. So we're pretty much on the edge, folks. On the edge.
That video has gotten a lot of views. It's gotten like 260 views.
Which is so amazing because it's a really long video.
It's 28 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's at least had an interesting discussion started from it, I think. But
yeah.
That's beside the point here. We don't wanna delve back into that well.
I don't know. Do we want to talk about that video?
Because if we talk about it, then that means that I could put a picture of Rush Limbaugh on it, which means that we could have more people sort of blindly plussing it and watching it.
And we could talk about and pimp her blog post.
See, that's exactly right. That's what I was trying to do. I was trying to segue into Rorschach Republicans, because that's something I really wanted to talk about.
Yeah. Go fish.
Well, now I done wrote the thing, and of course I don't have the link open, but I think I can remember.
Wait, pimp your own blog.
I'm going to read it, but I thought everybody already had the link, and I thought, I can just do this from memory. No.
I have the link. It's right here. It's, I cannot believe it.
I have the link. It's right here, and I don't see nothing. All right, no, I do have it open, and I wanted to read the opening because I thought it was
very clever,
striking and clever, and, I broke my arm patting myself on the back with it. So I started out with some statements that I wanted people to check themselves with, and then I'll say why. The first one was, if you come across the word liberty and instantly equate that with Ron Paul Nutter, you might be a Rorschach Republican. If you see a picture of Chris Christie featured in an article and then immediately spew reasons why he shouldn't be president without reading the article, now I didn't say that was it, that you should just get over the fact that he's going to be a presidential candidate. I said without reading the article, you might be a Rorschach Republican. If you encounter a Jon Stewart video that... And you comment about how awful he is without reading the introductory paragraph of the poster, you might be a Rorschach Republican. If you see the words immigration reform and always translate that to amnesty, you might be a Rorschach Republican. And finally, if you saw the title of the post, Rorschach Republicans, and said, well, I'm a conservative or a libertarian, not a Republican, so this doesn't apply to me, and you ignored it, you might be a Rorschach Republican. The deal, the story that goes behind this is that so often, once we're done with the refinery, we put together clips about everything that we've done, just about everything we talk to. This is going to be a clip-heavy show coming up next week. I'm just going to tell you people, this has been a great discussion. But we put together mini snippets for people who don't have 2 hours to commit, people who don't have the time to sit in front of a computer monitor and get everything. They can engage on one issue or, one video a day, and it breaks it into bite-sized pieces for people so that they're not left out by virtue of not being able to be here live with us or watch 2 hours on their own. But when we do this, so often we're putting together a lead that goes with it in our shares. Here's what we're thinking about. Here's what we want you to consider. Here's an idea for you to think about. And JD will put a image, hopefully it's one that's eye-catching and interesting, Rush Limbaugh, and that will get people to pay attention to the link. Or we'll write a story on our blog post and we'll add an image that will attempt to draw people in. And so often, and this is to the embarrassment and shame of the entire rightward end of the spectrum when people do this, not even click the link, look at the share, see the image of Chris Christie, see the image of somebody else, Rand Paul, Ron Paul, whoever, it might be Marco Rubio, whatever, and immediately comment without making an effort even to read the content. And here's why this bothers me. One of the principles that I've developed over the years is that you can learn something from everybody. It may not be the thing to do. It might be the cautionary tale. But you can learn something from everybody. What did we learn about the video, say, that was Republicans or people? We learned that you don't use stock photos when there are real Republicans out there to do that with. That nobody can figure out why, but we learned from that. And we learned how that can be turned against us. What did we learn from Mitt Romney's campaign or Chris Christie speaking here or Marco Rubio saying that? We should be asking ourselves, and here's why. If there is a tactic that's available from someone whom I find even abhorrent, and they have something I need to win, I'm committed, no matter how much I dislike them or am disgusted by them, to taking and co-opting that tactic or that strategy, not only in order to prevail in general, but so that I beat that philosophy. I beat that guy's thought process with his own tactics, if necessary. It's a major principle that you can learn from everyone. You may not like to. Jon Stewart may make your skin crawl, but there's something to be learned from everyone. And therefore, even though Chris Christie may be part of an article or a video that I want to share, showing how to go after unions, which is something every candidate needs to be able to speak to, union talking points, and I'm making the point about Chris Christie and his union talking points, so many times the thread devolves into, oh, Christie's a jerk, Christie's a fat ass, Christie's a whatever, and it's name-calling and it's unproductive. And worse than that, JD pointed it out, I hadn't even thought about it, it's just plain rude. It is just plain, if you don't engage with the content, just don't engage. Just please pass it by and wave as you go on to the next thread. Otherwise, all you're doing is emoting. You are emoting your politics. And there is no way that that is helpful at all. And so I really wanted to call people out who are just, Rorschach. They see a picture, they react to it. That was the closest thing I could think of as an analogy besides knee-jerk, which has been overused. And so even what I did on the image, I took a picture of Chris Christie and silhouetted it and reversed it and put them together to make sort of a pseudo Rorschach just to see if people reacted to that. But the whole thing is, don't be a jerk online. If you don't believe you can learn from somebody, move along. There's nothing to see here. Let the grown-ups talk.
Yeah, I would say don't even wave because, I mean, that gets rude too. This is something that is on my nerves constantly, as you outlined, because we do these clips and we try and get people to click on them, get people to engage and view the clips. But there's a difference between viewing and seeing somebody and just instantly doing that reaction. And It's ridiculous. I can't tell you how many times we get comments on our videos that are just awful, abhorrent comments from people saying really nasty things that aren't relevant to the video or really even to the picture a lot of the time. It's a non sequitur that people leave because they feel like they need to, because they're special, because I don't know what it is that makes people think, oh, hey, you know what? I'm not going to invest the time it takes to watch this video, so I'm going to just leave my 2 cents anyway because I'm smarter, so I'm just going to do it, and I can just guess. I'll just guess what it's about.
What's so funny to me is you look like a, you know, like you're missing a few, you know, knives in your drawer when you do that. You don't look intelligent when you comment a non sequitur on a piece that's about something completely different. You just don't. I'm here to tell you.
And it's like there's a compulsion to share. You know, if it's less important that I read and learn from other people and more important that I share my thoughts with them, because I am a special snowflake, and I've got all of this self-esteem that I've been raised with from day one because my parents wanted me to have good self-esteem, and by God, I have it. And I'm going to post selfies every day, and I'm going to share pictures of all this kind of stuff because I assume everybody's interested, and I'm going to comment on things I haven't even read or looked at because my thoughts about things and my feelings, and because really it's not my thoughts that I'm sharing, it's my feelings that I'm sharing, and certainly you'll share that selfie with everyone, right? My feelings must be shared because everyone needs an opportunity to admire my feelings. And certainly they're going to validate my feelings and tell me that my feelings were appropriate. And it's hard for me to see these non sequitur comments that are, you know, clearly not only did you not watch the 5-minute video, you didn't actually read the intro text of the post, nor did you read the words that were overlaying the photograph of Chris Christie. You saw a photograph of Chris Christie, and you wrote a paragraph or two about what a horrible president he would be. And it's like, well, that wasn't even anywhere near what we were talking about.
The pictures have words on them.
Right.
They have words. Right. There are words there.
I got accused of being a flack for the establishment.
Sure, sure.
Do I have to go into my bona fides? Really?
Well, because I put together that campaign 2014 and have been putting out things that were marketing promotions for GOP candidates, I've absolutely been accused of being a GOP operative and of turning the Conservative Union into a Republican GOP community, and it's not. That's what I'm posting. Everybody else is free to post their own stuff. I'm not removing other people's stuff about other candidates. It's just this is what I'm doing. But yeah, we have to deal with the fact that we are flax and rhinos and all of that. And on the one hand, I want to call people on it when they comment without reading, and I do sometimes, but I always feel like I'm being a jerk for doing it because people are busy and they're trying to engage, and I don't want to punish or reprimand that, but I do want to help people, or I do want to encourage a little more thoughtfulness and a little less emoting. Engage in a discussion, lead a discussion, have a discussion. Don't just feel at me.
Well, what I've been doing, and it's something that I've been, you might actually see them from time to time, is I've been trying to post comments asking the people who sort of, you know, you can sometimes guess who has seen the video and who hasn't seen the video, and if somebody makes a statement about, you know, whatever having to do with the video in the video, it's always nice to ask them what they thought about the video. If you ask specific questions about the video to them, you can sometimes sort of coax them to recant or go back in and take a look and revise what their statement is about these things. And that happened a few times.
On this one Chris Christie one, there was a gentleman who made a comment that was quite obvious that he hadn't watched the video, and he got enough questions back about it that he actually did take the time to watch the video. And after watching the video, he then provided an excellent feedback comment on the topic of the video, and also noting and admitting, which I thought was really gracious, he said, now that I realize that I was making a knee-jerk comment, and he used the phrase knee-jerk, now that I realize I made a knee-jerk comment, I've noticed a failing in myself, and I'm going to try to get better about that. Now, about that video, that was really some interesting stuff you were talking about, blah, blah, blah. I was like, well, that was pretty gracious and mature.
And, see, this is what nice gets you, because me, you don't want me engaging in that, because I'm just going to be a jerk about it. Did you even read it? Did you even watch it? I don't have time for you. Thank you, Lord, for bringing people into my life who have better manners and are nicer than I am.
Oh, don't count on me always being that.
it's easier to be a cooler head up in the atmosphere, so...
And this is not a problem exclusive to the right, because you see that on social media, so much of it is visual medium, and it's all about sharing. It's not about reading and learning. It's about sharing. The words that we see that are promoted about what to do on a social network is to share. And so people do this about videos and pictures and articles of every topic. It's just that I only care about conservatives.
Well, and I just want people to think I'm, to think, first of all, but to be better than that. Aren't you going to do more than the left does with your politics? Aren't you going to be more than the left is with their all emotion all the time politics? Aren't you going to think through an issue? Maybe check the way you think about something, examine a different idea. What's interesting to me is how much you can get from having a conversation with somebody else. How much do we all challenge each other every week having these discussions? Do you know anybody else who's doing this kind of thing? I don't. I feel like I've grown so much in almost a year that we've been doing this. And I think harder about things, and I think faster sometimes about things, because I have to. I'm on this, hangout with these people who are so smart and have so many different perspectives and have read so much more in some cases in places I never go than I do. It is enormously humbling to be around people like that, and it helps me want to be better. Why is that not a value that these people share? I don't know. I'm excited to learn new stuff, to be challenged, to find my way through an issue that I hadn't thought about before. That gets me excited. I just don't know people. I don't understand people who think they know it all.
Yeah, me neither. I'm addicted to learning, and you guys feed my addiction every week, which is awesome. And that came a few minutes after my discussion of meth. Oh, crap. You guys, I'm in trouble.
The DEA is coming. It is a foregone conclusion at this point.
If I'm not here next week, I need to gather bail money.
Yes, I need to address comments in the chat. There are some accusations that the reason that you love Chris Christie is that you are both sort of mean and rhinos. Is this the case?
I'm a rhinocorn. He can only aspire to what I am. Remember.
So, yes.
Yes. He's the plain variety. I am the special rhinocorn.
Very good. As long as we have that all cleared up, Rob, no, that is not the case. Lovely. The commentary, that was the best part the best part about this article was the reaction to the article itself.
And there were some that were reacting to the title, Rorschach Republicans, talking about how I'm more of a conservative Tea Partier than I am a Republican, and the GOP party has got, it's like, oh my God, that's so meta-ignorant, or not
nailed
ignorant.
It!
Meta-ignorant. Nailed it. We were having that discussion. We actually had that discussion, that it was just...
like, whoa.
You know, I'm really grateful, though, for everybody who shared that and passed it around. It has gotten, a lot of attention on our site, and that's been, it's ended a real bad writing drought for me. So the key to getting me to write is to make me angry, apparently. I'm just saying that and throwing that out there to people. But also, Taylor, the host of The Right War, is actually invited me on tomorrow to talk about that tomorrow evening. That is 10 Central. So that's going to happen. So we'll get, maybe a few more eyeballs on it. And the thing is, between Rorschach Republicans and Dexter Defense, I want those phrases to become things. I'm proud of those, too.
As well you should be. As well you should be. And, it's hard. I feel like we're not naming names, but we are criticizing some very specific people. And the deal is, everyone has a bad day, and everyone, I absolutely have reacted and commented on articles that I haven't read. I have done it. Sometimes I will confess that I haven't read it, and usually I'll do it on Pradeep Shankar's posts, because I love commenting on his posts without having read the article, and then telling him that I did it, because... because it's just fun.
Because can a human read everything he posts in one day?
Hell no. And he posts stories from Vox, and I'm just not going to go there. It's like, I'm going to comment based on the headline, because tell me anything important that I'm missing, because I'm not going to click on Vox. That I'm not going to infect my computer with that.
Well, see, at least in that scenario, that's somewhat informed on the post. So what you're saying is that you don't want to click on the link because you don't want to give Vox hits,
right?
Which is acceptable. You could see that's an acceptable thing for one to say, and then ask for some further information that would not require you to give them any more clicks. That makes sense. That's fine. And saying, oh hey, yeah, I'm not going over there personally because I have had a problem with their journalistic standards in the past or something like that. That is a substantive post to some extent. Sure, it doesn't exactly comment on the story itself, but it's better than just saying, I hate them. There's a reason why you are backing away from the post. There's something, and you're looking for more information. If you're going through it like that, I get it. It's the blind sort of Chris Christie is for amnesty in regards to a post that has nothing to do with Chris Christie on amnesty.
Other than it just had a picture of Chris Christie, yeah.
Yeah.
Rorschach, it's just a freaking Rorschach test. Is everything going to be just online, emotional, emotional personality tests for people?
And, do you get to, okay, this is what I'm thinking and feeling, so I'm going to post this comment on the next other person's shared post that I see, whether it's pertinent or not. And sometimes I think that's happened. That happens. And I've done that to crew, by the way. But again, that's me joking with my friends. It's like I'll post some random unrelated thing, but...
Maybe what I need to do the next time this happens is go to that person's page and go to two or three posts and just post non sequiturs on their stuff. How do you like it?
But, I don't want to discourage people because they are engaging, and they're engaging on politics. And even the one that was like the meta Rorschach comment, the points that she was making about the different branches of conservatism were valid and interesting. They were just not right on that post. It's like, I want to hear more of your opinion. Just That would be a great post. Just make it on its own. Don't make it here because this is wrong. Oh, and yes, Andy thinks some people should be discouraged, but that's because Andy's mean. He's just
well, how do you know that was Andy? How are you sure that was see?
See?
Oh man, I was giving Andy the credit for being mean. I can see Corey's just nice and sweet.
I'm never mean.
Nobody would believe it of Corey anyway.
Yeah, well, she has me fooled.
Yeah, I know. Nobody ever believes it of me, so that's why I can get away with it. I've seen this so much lately. There are a couple Facebook pages that I used to go to all the time that I loved, and I can't even handle going out there anymore because all they do is fight and bicker over the silliest things. Half the time it doesn't make any sense, and then I think they're just trying to go for a record number of comments. I mean, 500, 600, 700 comments on one thread. Ugh. And after a while, it's like, guys, this isn't even productive. Do you even remember what you were talking about?
Well, and it doesn't advance the conservative movement at all. It just keeps it keeps them occupied and too busy to do anything really productive.
Yeah, but what bothers me is that I'm seeing this, you know, this small group of people who are ganging up on anyone who comes in with trying to engage them in a conversation. And then they really are giving that group or that movement, whether it's Republican or Tea Party or conservative, a bad name. Because if you're new to the area and maybe you just want to see what's going on in Aurora, Colorado or Houston, Texas, and you go out and look at some of the local conservative activist pages and you see these types of fights going on, the last thing you're going to do is think, oh, this looks like a great group I want to get involved in.
It's pure hate. It's just a hate fest. It's an absolute feeding frenzy hate fest, attacking anyone who does not absolutely despise the Republican Party.
Don't we typically think of toddlers when we think of people that are just, you know, emoting all the time and not thinking through processes? I'm not saying anything, but I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Well, it's so vicious, and there's no... And here's the thing. These aren't Tea Partiers. These aren't patriots. They claim to be, but what they do is they come on to... I mean, there are a lot of wonderful Tea Party patriots on these pages, don't get me wrong. But then you get this little group that comes on these things and takes them over, and they're only there for one reason and one goal. Only one goal, and that is to divide the Democrats' opposition. That's their only goal. Divide the Democrats' opposition, cause pain to the right, hurt the right, damage the right. And that's the only reason they're there, and they lash out and they mock anybody. And they just swarm like bees and mock anyone who tries to offer any kind of hope or help or strategy or anything. They are immediately, they're ogres, they're rhinos,
establishment,
oh my. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And so you think that really all it would take is the Soros crowd, and I use Soros' name just because it's just a Democracy Alliance funded type of person. You just need one or maybe two to hit a page, right, or to hit a comment thread, and there will be two or three useful idiots that really are Tea Party believers, real true believers, that'll go along with the instigator. So in this comment thread or on this page where you have five or six problem people, one of them actually is maybe a Democrat operative with the goal of distracting the conservatives, and the other ones are actually conservatives who have been fooled.
Right, and you have no idea who, because if you try to point it out, then you're a conspiracy nut.
Right, right.
Poor impulse control. That's what this boils down to.
Right.
Right there.
Well, and the thing is, we're not their parents, so we can't control them. All we can do is control ourselves and lead by example. So,
And shame them.
Which, when we've had a bad day and we need to be entertained, yes, shaming other people can be our own little bit of fun. or talking about them behind their back or whatever. Because, yes, that happens. But really the best thing, the real thing that we need to do and that I try to do, I'm so bad at always doing it. I just try. I ignore it when I can. I try to guide people out of it when I feel like I don't want to ignore it. And then I mostly just try to set a better example of not falling for and not doing it, but providing alternative good conversations or good posts or information and just providing the good stuff and counting on the good people to follow where they can and, I don't know, just ignoring it and trying to be the grown-up in the room. And, wow, I fail at that a lot. But
the problem, Leslie, is even if you succeed at it, here's the problem now. They're taking over whole sites and wrecking them. I mean, even things like, you know, Town Hall, which I love going on Town Hall. There's no use even posting in the blog there anymore. You just get, I mean, it's just troll city, attacks, mocking attacks. I mean, you know, and then Facebook, you know, Tea Party sites, I believe, there's no way this is unique. I believe Tea Party sites all over the country have been taken over by wolves. And, you know, I could be wrong. I'm not out there. I don't know. But it just wouldn't surprise me because I know the Democrats. And I know that, you know, most of the people on there are not a wolf, but that all they got to do is spot a couple among them and get them going. And it is incredibly effective for depressing voter turnout amongst Republicans, and that's the goal.
Right, that's the thing. We get a lot of fatalistic commentary, you know, why even bother? They're all the same, Democrats and Republicans, and, you know, it doesn't really matter, blah, blah, blah. And, yeah, what it does is it depresses turnout, and what we really need to be doing is being cheerleaders to get people to the polls for the next week. And then we have to deal with the fact that we're accused of being GOP shills. And I'm so not. And I'm so not in love with the GOP. They're the organizational tool that I think we should use to achieve our goals, but I don't know what the best approach is. Do we just sometimes stumble along as best we're doing now, ignore what we can, confront what we can't ignore? I mean, I don't know.
One thing that we've been kind of doing, we just don't have enough time, is that if you do decide to engage and you can present your ideas well and come across as the reasoned voice that's logical, that makes sense, you know, present the long-term plan, we're seeing that some of these instigators are actually just kind of falling apart after a while. Because they get so wound up, they get so angry, they just start spouting off. And after a while, they don't even really make a whole lot of sense anymore. And then it's kind of funny because it brings out the more reasonable voices that are on those pages. And then they start to join into the conversation and they start to pick apart the irrational person or persons. And it just becomes a big bloodbath, unfortunately. But at least that way, you can see that these people are the instigators. They are not reasonable people. They are there to cause trouble and division.
I don't know. I just wrote an article. I wish I'd been able to post it before tonight. It's called "The Democrats Are Our Southern Border." And what I do is I pose a simple question that I like posing to these people who want to say we're all... Night, Ryan. By the way, night, Ryan.
Night, Ryan.
Yeah, I know. I just finished writing it about an hour before we went on air and typing it up. But basically what I do is I pose a question. And I say, how many of you... because they say it doesn't matter and we're just not going to vote, we're not going to do this, we're going to stand aside, or we're going to vote third party. And I go, because the Republicans, they're just going to take the country down slowly while the Democrats take it down quickly. And I say, okay, tell me this, how many of you want the borders of our country, the borders, you know, secured? And they're like, they all say, well, yeah, we do. And I say, which ones, southern or northern? And they're like, well, the southern border. I go, yeah, of course, you want the southern border. You want to put all our resources there first. Why? Because that's where the greatest incursion is coming, right? It's many, many, many times worse than the incursion coming across our northern border. So you want to put our resources to first secure the southern border because that's where the greatest threat to our liberty, to our sovereignty is. Okay, well, why aren't we doing that with our vote? Okay, you have one vote. Where is the greatest incursion coming? From the Democrats or from the Republicans? The Democrats are our southern border. They are the great incursion against our liberties. They're the ones, oh, yes, the Republicans have an incursion against our liberties at times too. Okay, and you can point those out. Well, let's go at gun rights. Let's go at abortion rights. Let's go at, one thing after the other, issue after issue after issue. You can make some comparisons, but they fall apart very quickly. And what I say is this. You have one vote. You need to allocate your vote to the greatest chance to defeat the greatest incursion. You've got to aim your vote at the southern border of politics. You must stop, seal this first. Then we can turn our attention after this election to the northern border. But we have to go after the southern border first, and the Democrats are our southern border. So that's kind of what I've been using with them, and just to kind of make it a little more difficult on them. First, lure them in. You know, which border do we shut down first? Well, why would you shut down one ahead of the other? Because there's a much greater incursion there than the other. So that's where you got to put your efforts and your vote.
I like that. I like that a whole lot. Yay, Andy.
It's a short one, too. I'll be posting as soon as we can.
Well, we'll share the crap out of it.
Absolutely. And that's, obviously, whenever there's new party of choice content up, that's something that we need to distribute. We're getting really close to getting out of here. But before we do, I really want to throw this over to Fishy in a second, because next Tuesday is obviously Election Day. We will be seeing you guys in November the next time that we come together. We will be on Wednesday instead of Tuesday next week, so we'll have a lot of stuff to talk about. But before we do that, I really want to sort of get into what we should be focused on after the election is done. So regardless of wins, regardless of losses, where our brains need to be once the election is said and done. That's going to be a really important thing, something we've talked about here before. But I think, Fishy, if you could get into that a little bit, where we need to be mentally after the election.
Well, we've talked so often about that shorter election cycle. Andy talks about how we don't do any messaging until right before an election, and then we're all flooding into communities and whatever. In December, in January, if you have to take that much time off, you should be starting to think after this election, what am I going to do to get into that 24-month cycle? Commit to one thing. One area, one narrative, one subject. You could become an expert on one thing in a relatively short period of time in terms of policy and things that we're dealing with. But we need to commit to that full 24-month cycle, because presidential primaries, by the way, the election season for 2016 starts in about a week and a half. I'm not kidding when I say.
Oh, right. It starts in 8 days.
Yes. You'll give people a couple days to recover, but then immediately we're going to be bombarded with talk of 2016 based on whatever happens out of this election. We don't have the luxury to wait until January of 2016 to worry about these things. And not only do we need to get through that cycle, but we've got to pay attention to the demographics. We've got to pay attention to the messaging. Some of the things we talked about tonight, learn more about them. People can learn more about asset forfeiture and seizure. They can learn more about the, well, right now there's just something that's interesting. They're talking about monitoring and regulating YouTube political videos. That's an article we didn't get to, but mm-hmm. that's something that could be changing the face of elections. If you learn about one or two issues and become the expert in your field, I mean, in your circle around that, you'll have a better chance of impacting people, and you'll know how to approach the issue with different constituencies if you're paying attention, if you're listening to you know, messages like what Andy's talking about, dealing with war on women, or you know, watching videos about how to reach certain communities. Find what connects. But the most important thing above all of that is find people to listen to and hear feedback from about things like why they don't pay attention to politics, or what makes them make decisions about politics. What are they passionate about? What do they vote based on? Listen to people's concerns and become that person who does, as Andy recommends, asks them a question, steps back and listens instead of immediately launching into your view. We've talked this whole year, almost a year now, about all the messaging, the things that we want to see happen, the things we want our politicians to do and say. But Leslie's right. It's not going to be those guys who move the culture. Those guys aren't equipped to move the culture. We are. So that's how you start. Learn about an issue and then become someone who speaks out and talks about that issue. Then learn about another one and become an expert on two and three and four. And start just picking one thing at a time, one bite at a time. But make sure you're listening to people when you're also gathering that information.
And for Pete's sake, if we win big, if this is like a crazy wave election and we like crush the Democrats, please, please, please don't think that that means anything for 2016. Please don't think that means that we can just put our feet up and coast because, you know, clearly we're going to win in 2016 because of a wave election in 2014. We saw what happened in 2010, the wave election in 2010, and we saw what happened in 2012. So please,
let's and 2016 keep things in perspective. 2016 where it is going to be harder to defend any kind of a Senate majority that we may earn. Yeah. It'll be really, that's going to be much harder for us than this environment.
It's something that we need to remember that 2012 happened, and 2016 is going to be a different election from 2014, is going to be a different election from 2015, is going to be a different election. These are not the same elections. They're different elections. We need to address them individually. We can't just imagine that if we have a huge win next week, which I hope that we do, but if we have a huge win next week, it does not translate into a Republican president in 2016.
No.
You know, it's pretty exciting. I mean, it's interesting you bring that up because, you know, every Thursday we go on that show with Chris Cook here in town. And the topic I'm proposing, I'll be sending her an email tomorrow, that I want was after Tuesday, building trust.
Exactly.
And you know, we get all panicked because we got so little time to move voters. And what I want to do is talk about ways we can build trust within the conservative movement with each other and with those demographics we haven't been reaching. And we have a wonderful opportunity. We're not in a hurry now. 2015 can all be about, and if you do it right, it can all be about building trust, building bridges with those groups that have been divided up until now. The heat is off. The election's over. No more hurry, hurry, rush, rush. You can't fix a relationship that way. And we can do it. And so I'll be talking about how we can start that process.
Awesome. And I think if we do have a small wave or a big wave or whatever, we need to realize that what's going to happen a week from now is voters voting against the Democrats. We have not earned a vote for the Republican Party. We haven't earned it. We might get it, but we have not earned it. And I would like to spend the next 2 years earning votes for the Republican Party. And with that, I think we can call it a day. Can we call it a day? Yeah, we're good.
Wait. Last thing, I want everybody to give their prediction. I'm seeing 51 Senate seats. 51. Come on, put yourself out there.
I'm going to say we don't lose any of the three that are at risk. And we will gain, which means we have to net six. We'll get those six, which will put us over the top. I say we'll get maybe one more. So I'm going to say 52, but I'm skeptical.
I say 50, and Joe Biden ends up making decisions for the next 2 years.
I like that. That would be great. That would just be so awesome if we could have that. I think that.
Oh, and I have an announcement. Next week it's just going to be the two of us, the Conservative Union and Party of Choice, because Free Radical Network is going to be gone. They both gave pessimistic answers. We don't want them in that group anymore.
I was joking.
This is their last show. They hadn't told you yet, but this is their last show. Oh, my God.
What did I do? What's your prediction?
My prediction is that we are going to get more seats than you might think. That's what my prediction is. I'm not going to give a bad number. We're going to get more seats than you might think.
Good God, you're a politician. That's like a non-answer answer, isn't it?
It is. It's a very non-answer answer.
you're saying.
I think that Louisiana is going to be decided next year.
Well, no, Louisiana will be decided in November.
No.
They run next in a month. They have the runoff in a month. So it'll be December. It's Georgia that goes till January.
I thought that it was Louisiana that went till.
Louisiana has the jungle primary on November 4th. The top two out of that, which will be Mary Landrieu and other guy. I can't believe it. Whatever. It's been a long day. So it'll be Mary Landrieu and
the guy that's not Manus. Right. The guy that's not Rob Manus.
The Republican. They'll have their runoff in December, so they just have 1 month. But Georgia is the one that could end up going for a runoff, and Georgia's runoff doesn't go until January, which would make Christmas hell if that's for the 50th seat.
None isn't going to get it. So Georgia is going. I'll say that for sure. Georgia is going to be Republican. Hold. We are going to hold Georgia.
Wow.
You think Purdue's going to get over 50? And
I think Purdue's going to get over 50.
And so we won't have a runoff. Nice.
I don't think that we're going to have a runoff in Georgia.
Really? None's.
I like that.
Okay.
I like that. Everybody vote. If you've already voted, make other people vote. If you live in Colorado, and it's all mail-in ballot. Photocopiers are, they've got FedEx machines, postal machines. Do your duty.
Media said, Matters for America. Conservative Union is trying to promote conservative voter fraud in Colorado. I'm sure. Again, when the DEA comes, you'll also get somebody from the FEC.
From
the DOJ and from the FEC. So you're just...
You're wrapping up alphabet soup there, honey.
They're all parked up at the end of the street right now, figuring out which tactical vehicle are we using.
They're sitting in the DHS van down the street.
You guys seen the early voting in Colorado?
Yes, I have.
I mean, now, here's the thing. I believe the late votes are going to break heavy Democrat because of the women vote. I really do. And I believe that's going to be nationwide. So that's my prediction. Late votes will break heavily Democrat, just as they did in 2012. I could be wrong.
Because there have been so many stories about, so many horse race stories, which is all that the media is putting out is horse race stories, so many of those about how it's going to be a Republican wave, that so many Republicans have gotten complacent.
Well, there's that. But in early voting, Republicans are outpacing Democrats right now in Colorado. 4 years ago at this point, Republicans were outpacing Democrats by about 15,000 votes. This year, it's 60,000
wow.
votes that they're outpacing Democrats by in early voting. But once again, I really believe the late voting is going to break heavily to the Democrats. I believe the woman vote will break heavily for the Democrats at the end. Like, heavily.
Okay, so there's super pessimist, there's skeptical optimist, and then there's, well, okay, no. Free radical, Felicia is super pessimist, and Andy is pretty much of a pessimist, and I'm a skeptical optimist, and JD is our youthful, exuberant super optimist. So we'll see which of us is going to be more right. It'll probably be me or Andy because we're the ones in the middle of the road. You know, you extremists.
No. You're both rhinos. So.
Well, true. Now JD's not the dope smoking hippie. You guys in Colorado, hello. It's legal for you people.
No. I repeat what a libertarian said at one of my speeches. When marijuana was brought up, he said, now that it's legal, it's not fun anymore.
Be careful what you wish for. You just might get it. Yeah.
The fun. He's not interested.
There you have it. Well, guys, it's been great, and we will see you all next week, next Wednesday at 8:30, to celebrate or cry together, whichever way it might be.
Okay.
That's it for this week's show.